better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life, if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, July the 25th, 2024, and we have an expert council show today because it is Thursday. We have Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini. Talking about how there's all these calls for unity right now. Unity. Everybody has to get on board and be unity. That's the only way you can have democracy, right? You're going to have everybody agree with everything. That's a real democracy where whatever they say, you parrot back and you... No. But one of the things that they point out here, and I think this is a very interesting observation, when you have a hyper-interventionist government, a government that sticks its fingers in every pie all over the globe, you will never have unity. Like, we would never have unity anyway, as in across the board and all things. What common sense people, what people with brains who remember some unity from, let's say, the 1980s mean when they say unity is, let's say we could have four or five key ideals, and even if we have different ideas about how to get there and different ideas about other things, at least in those four or five things, as Americans, we agree. As long as we are fucking with the rest of the world, we are not going to get there ever. It's impossible. They will explain it. Andy McCann will talk about nutrition versus medical intervention for certain health conditions, especially obesity. Sean Mills will talk about choosing the right batteries for a battery bank and about some issues with battery safety here. In this case, I believe, if I remember right, this is for an RV, so this is a mobile system as well. And then I have an interesting thing, and I'm going to try to do more stuff like this. I got a question, and I sent it to Ben Falk, Nick Ferguson, and Jeff Lawton. I'm going to reach out to Jeff today and see, is he traveling really heavy right now or something? Because usually, Jeff, I send him a question, and boom, it's back. And I haven't heard from Jeff for like two questions now, and that's unusual. So Jeff didn't answer, but Ben and Nick did, and I'm going to. And the question is basically a half-acre homesteading question. They're more on like 0.65 or 0.66, like two-thirds of an acre. But half-acre, it's kind of in that range. And basically, they have a brand-new place. It is like, you know, a suburban home with a big lot, basically. And there is no infrastructure for anything at all for like homestead, food production, permaculture, none, zero. So I thought it'd be cool if we had different experts answer the same question, and then I get the easy job where I get to hear what they say, and then I get to follow up on it with my own segment on that. Then I've got a question for Eric Hammond, and it's about dealing with really old gas, like 2 years old, been sitting in cans for 2 years. And then I have a question I'm going to answer on aquatics, and this is choosing between, and I don't really have names for these, so like a cascade versus individual multi-tank delivery in aquaponics. I guess it'd be cascade versus manifold delivery would be another way to look at it. And this is one of those questions that doesn't have a definitive right answer. It's more about we have to examine the nature of the system itself, and then we have to determine which method we want to use based on all that knowledge put together. And I think this will help a lot of people that want to do some aquatic stuff have a better understanding of designing your system when you're throwing water from one tank to multiple tanks, and it's going to come back from that tank. When I say throw, I mean you're pumping it, and you're trying to decide, well, what does that entire infrastructure look like as far as distribution and return? You're creating a loop in this system. Well, there's more than one way to create a loop, believe it or not. It's not all just straight linear. There's multiple ways to do it, and we're going to talk about that to wrap things up. Before we get into that, I want to remind you there's a couple ways you can help support this show. One, become a member of the MSB. The Member Support Brigade is the way that you can support this show at $50 a year. $50 a year. There are so many discount partners in the MSB. If you use the discounts, you are going to get your money back. I got an email today. The guy did the math, and he said, this year, I have taken over $400 in discounts. $400 in discounts. He's like, the MSB's worth three times the money easy. Now, he's a guy that uses quite a bit of stuff with cannabis. I think he had a purchase in there from Start 9, so that adds up pretty quick, but still, you see what I mean. Like, if you're going to use the products that we our vendors offer, just use the discount codes, get your money back. It's like you're getting paid to help me. That's literally when I built it, I came up with that idea. Can I figure out a way to pay people to help me? And that's why I came up with the version that I have. The next thing I want to talk to you about today, though, is the product reviews I do at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I've done that for years. It's all been Amazon reviews. Now we have Lavore. I've reviewed two items this week, and I think you should check them both out. One is the compact emergency air compressors. These things are great. They come in a case about the size of like a standard bricklayer's brick. Is how big the largest best one is. There's also some lower cost options. You do not want to be stuck on the side of the road with a flat tire. I'll tell you what else you don't want to do. You do not want to be stuck on the side of the road changing a tire. Maybe like a small road with a big shoulder without cars doing 95 miles an hour or whatever. But the highway, if you have to stop, you want to get the heck where you're going as quick as possible. You pair one of these up and add a plug kit to it, by the way, and you can get yourself out of most situations. Not all. I had one years ago. I ran over a piece of angle iron. There was no inflating that tire or plugging it, and I had to change it on the Dallas tollway. And that was the day I said, I'm only doing this because I have to. And by God, my wife will never do this, no matter whether she can change. And she can change the tire. I taught her how. But not on the side of a freaking interstate. No. So you need to have one of these. They also charge your mobile devices and things like that as well. And we also brought you this week from Vavore the collapsible rain barrels and bladders. Quite a few of you guys have picked up the barrels. I haven't seen anybody pick up a bladder yet. You want to check the bladders out, too. It's just a different way of storing water. And I want you to think about water storage, not just rain catch to irrigate your garden with this stuff. There's going to be a giant storm coming. You could have water knocked out. Fill one of these up and sit it in your bathtub and then fill it up, because it's going to weigh 800 pounds, by the way, when you have it full of water. The bladders do the same thing. You can retrieve water from remote locations with them. Camping applications, beach trip, if you can drive on your beach, like here in Texas, we can actually drive on the beach. Like, lots of applications of this stuff beyond just a rain barrel for watering a garden. Anyway, check those out as well. You can always find that stuff at tspaz.com. And with those two, they're very recent, so just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and begin scrolling, and you shall see them. And remember, you won't miss any of this stuff if you're on the Daily Mail. I know that's a newspaper magazine type thing out of the UK. But for me, it's the Daily Email, right? But Daily Mail sounds better. So go to the site, click on Daily Mail in the tabs, fill out the form, and you'll get an email once a day. That's all, once a day during the week, nothing on the weekends, unless there's something special comes up. And all it says is, here's the things that came out today. That's it. There's nothing else. I don't write you these long form letters or crap like that. It's like, hey, here's what the episode is. Here's the item of the day. Here's some other thing going on. Check you out. See you later. And you can unsub at any time. With that, let's drop in and hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on why hyper-intervention of your government makes unity of your nation freaking impossible.
And I was just wondering, Chris, I imagine you watch television a little bit, but if you didn't watch it, I don't blame you last night. I watched some of it, but I can tell you, Chris, the main theme that I got from the program last night was unity. If we all just together and do the same thing, that we all become robots and act out in a uniform manner, everything will be okay. The exact opposite of what liberty is all about. You know, I think that's the goal of the worst systems of the world. When you think about fascism and communism and all, they want unity, and they have marching orders. And if somebody said, well, where do you get your information? How do you define what is right and wrong? Oh, the party tells us that, the party leadership.
That's right, Dr. Paul. And yeah, we hate to break anybody's bubble, but unity is not possible when you have a government like ours. You know, government in its limited functions, protecting against force, against fraud, that's and maximum freedom. There, people can be unified, but government intervention, what we have, a hyper-interventionist government, it's constantly creating victims. And nobody wants to be a victim. So, and that's why Washington, D.C. is always buzzing with lobbyists. You know, they want to be the beneficiaries. They don't want to be the victims. And that's why elections are about money and mega donors. And so why do they bother? Why do they use the word unity? Well, because they want unity to blunt any opposition to what they want, you know, to whatever intervention they want. So if they want a war, they want unity. They don't want mass protests. You're going to mess up their war by protesting and throwing sand in the gears. So that's why they want to unify everybody. We are all going to be together, and let's go destroy. You know, so there can be no unity. It's either unity or interventionist government. You cannot have both. Right now, we have the biggest government in the history of the world. It intervenes in every single aspect of our lives. So we are so far from even thinking about unity before rolling back this monster that, you know, has gotten so big.
There, it's really, and Chris, you know, brought this out too. There are people who want it for special interests, just want the money. So they're people, they're not competing in the marketplace. They're competing for the club of government control. So which lobbying group is going to win out? We think it should be voluntary. We think there should be unity in a family, a neighborhood, churches, and all that. But it would all be voluntary, which is quite a bit different.
It's unity. Happens with decentralization, small groups. You know, that's where you'll get your unity, families primarily. You know, because we're social beings. We weren't meant to live alone. Okay, so people form communities based on common interests. You know, we're having a conference next month. People unified around our ideas. There'll be hundreds of people there. Nobody's forcing them to go. Nobody's forcing anybody to watch this show, all the people that watch this show. It's all done voluntarily. So if groups want to get together and practice communism, socialism, any ism that they want on their own, then fine. You know, we as libertarians have no problem with that. Just don't try to force it on anyone else. Look at the Amish people. They don't bother anybody, and nobody bothers them. Now, what if they changed their philosophy and said, you know what, we are exceptional, and we are going to take our form of life and go rampage across the country and make everybody be Amish? That would cause a big problem. That is what the United States has done. They filled their heads with, we are exceptional, and we're going to rampage across the world and make everybody like us. First of all, they can't make 300 million Americans all unified and living one way. They want to make 7 billion people. This is why this project is the stupidest thing in the world, and it is failing. We're watching it every single day, but it's the philosophy. They don't want unity in small groups. They want the world for themselves. They're not going to get it, but in the meantime, they're going to make this country, you know, desolate. That's what they're doing. You know, poor, immoral. You check off all the boxes. It's all happening because of these dumb ideas of trying to force everyone to live how they believe they should live.
You know, there is, in my opinion, this is not like a statement of fact. You won't find this in a book somewhere, at least not one that I've read yet. But in my opinion, there is one sacred freedom above all others that this country was truly founded on. And I'm going back colonial times, in first colony times, all the way from the Puritans forward. You know, the thing about the Puritans is they had these really strict rules, like laws, and you had to do these things or you're out or you're in trouble or you're going to Puritan prison or something like that, right? You know, you think you're a witch, maybe we'll hang you or burn you or some shit, right? But they had these very serious rules, and we think of them as people that would then be interfering with others' rights, but they actually wanted the rights to have their rules in their community, you know, kind of like the Amish do. The Amish don't bother anybody. They have rules, and if you don't follow them, you know, they don't burn witches or anything, like none that I know of. But you're not an Amish anymore. You're out. You're thrown out. But you don't have to stay. And so the sacred freedom I'm speaking to is the freedom to be left the hell alone, okay? If you do not have the freedom to be left alone, you will not have unity. That's another way of looking at this intervention. Because the intervention we're talking about here in their segment is intervention around the world, yes, but intervention in your life. And once you convince people that if you don't have a thing, the government should give you the thing, Well, then there's only one way to get the thing, and that is to get the government to take the thing from somebody else and give it to you. And at the same time, you want your thing, somebody else wants another thing, and they're going to take from you to give that other person that thing. That's not sharing, it's stealing. And you cannot have unity even on those four or five things if you don't first have the freedom to be left alone. We cannot leave anyone or anything alone. Our form of government, when they talked about exceptionalism, the original concept of American exceptionalism wasn't America had better people, smarter people, stronger people, tougher people, right? That wasn't what was meant by American exceptionalism. They meant our form of constitutional republic. That in America, because we had this incredible limitation placed on the state and freedom of people to seek out and pursue happiness, not be given happiness, pursue happiness, that we were exceptional as a place if you were in the opportunity that you had. And that's why we had some very exceptional results in many things. Have you noticed, as they interfere more in the lives of people, as the government grows bigger, that exceptionalism not only wanes, it's eradicated. Before Jimmy Carter, there wasn't a Department of Education. The United States was the number one market in the world educationally. Our children in high school outperformed the rest of the world. 1970s. Seems forever ago. It's 50-odd years. 40 to 50 years, depending on what part of the 70s you're talking about, right? Today, we're like number 30-something. We have the Department of Education. $50, $60 billion a year goes into that. Redundant spending, unnecessary. States have their own shit. We went from 1 to 30-something. Yeah. Gee, why can't we have unity? Maybe because you guys keep pissing everybody off at each other. You're asking for unity, right, in an ant mound, where you're constantly disturbing the ant mound with a stick and dropping ants from other mounds into it. Yeah, you're not going to get unity. You're going to get distress and fighting and then a belief that someone needs to fix everything for you, which is the plan. It is the plan, and it's always been the plan. And it will continue to be the plan as long as we continue to behave like insects versus humans. Anyway, moving on, let's talk about if you need to lose weight, should you even consider medical interventions or do it only with diet and exercise? How's that all work out? We'll hear from Andy McCann on that.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, answering your health and fitness questions. And Nick from Ohio asks, I like this one, and I don't think you're going to get the answer you expect from me, but how do I lose this dad bod / gut? Is it all food? When does surgery come into play? Okay, so yes, I am a guy who loves to get out there and exercise and eat, and they tell you that no exercise program can outrun a bad diet. So yeah, it's going to involve like changing the way you eat, but surgery and that sort of stuff is out there. And I mean, use it if you need to use it. I think this sounds a whole lot like another question we had about knees and how bad my knees are. And my dad had double knee replacement surgery. Then he got his shoulders replaced. And you're like, well, could he have worked his way through that? I mean, yeah, I don't know, maybe. But I mean, surgery is out there. And I mean, if you are the type of person who says, I never want to cut my body open, then yeah, let's give it a shot doing other stuff. But antibiotics can be good, right? Nip and tuck could be good. And so I guess I'm not so purist to say don't use science and technology around you. If you're one of those types that's like, well, you know, God wouldn't put that in you. I mean, I don't know. God made somebody invent it. So work out that in your own religion. But yes, there is a time and place for surgery. So I've got a buddy that does some CrossFit, and he was pretty big, and he was not into CrossFit, and he kept trying to lose weight. And everything he tried, and it seemed like, you know, on the surface, when you talk about it, you're like, yeah, you did the right things, but would fall back into the bad habits. And he's like, I just need to get over that this hump of getting rid of it. So he did. I actually have two buddies that do this, one guy and one's a girl. I mean, sure, there's a lot of girls, a lot of people out there that do this, but two that I know specifically that are into CrossFit. And If they both had that done, of course, there is some scarring that goes with it. You can go into surgery, they can cut stuff off, they can, you know, there's all sorts of stuff, go look that up. But basically, insert your program of choice. I mean, maybe even taking a pill, right? And there's some ramifications for that. So everything you do, no matter what it is going to be hard. I think you've heard me say it before. You have to choose your hard. What do you want to be? Being fat is hard. Being fit is hard. It's just a different hard. Being rich is kind of hard. Being poor is kind of hard, right? They're just different hards. Okay, so they did do this. One of them is, they had the weight cut off. They had the scarring. They did not want to do the plastic surgery yet. I'm not exactly sure why. I forgot why. And then over time, the habits are still catching back up to them. So the motivation of having the effect was high, but then time took over. And if you don't change the habits, then you're going to get the same thing you had before. You've got to change the habits. So the other friend did that, actually did do the plastic surgery. So I don't know, maybe there was something there. They saw the scarring. There was some repressed emotions. I don't know. I'm not that type of person. I'm a man. And what do you do with your emotions? If you're a guy, you bottle them up and shove them down and you just forget about them. So that person, she's doing pretty good. So I don't know if it's guy, girl. I don't know. It really, to me, what it looked like was a habit change that they could then do forever. So they're both putting in the time at the gym. I know what they do. I know mostly what they do. I don't see them all the time. But I have a guess at what their programming is like. I don't necessarily know what they're eating, but you can look and see. So when I see pictures of them or when we do meet in person, you can see kind of the effects of the food they eat. So, Nick, your question is, where does it begin, or does it have to only be food? No, but long-term food is the answer, and so is sweat. You've actually got to do something different. What is the Jack, help me out with the whole insanity is like doing the same. Anyway, you know what it is. It's like something. Anyway, you got to make a change. And I am totally fine if you go down the route of getting surgery. If that's going to give you the push you need to get in front of it, then great. Sometimes climbing the mountain is tough. And you're like, yes, I know if it's just one foot in front of the other, but dang, it's going to take me forever. And I just don't know if I can do that. Or you may be on the other side of it where like the doctor says, hey, this extra weight is really messing your knees up. I mean, there's an easy one, right? Do I go get knee replacement surgery by carrying this weight and trying to get rid of it? Or could I get rid of it and then change all my habits, right? So those are the choices you have to make. But Nick, I wouldn't be worried too much. Or at least let me say it like this. I think you're asking the right questions. So if you said it's only got to be food and it's never anything else. I mean, that's my world. And I'm even telling you, no, it doesn't have to be that way. And if you're the other way saying, hey, it's always surgery and it's always a pill, then you're probably going down the wrong road too. So you're going to have to change your food and you're going to have to change the way you sweat or work out or whatever. But the doctor can help you get there a little bit quicker and make an informed decision. I am not a doctor. I am not telling you to go do it. I'm not telling you not to do it. I'm just saying there is something that nobody can really measure, and that's your emotional well-being that goes into this stuff, the psychology of now I am smaller, right? So I would say do some research. Go online, Facebook maybe, and ask people, hey, who's done this? Or go to a CrossFit actually, you could probably go to go on Facebook and go to CrossFit's page and ask people. Weirdly, CrossFitters are super open about sharing what they've done. You probably get a lot of good insight from that. All right. I love the question. I love what you're thinking. I love that you put those questions together. I think Jack's probably going to give you an interesting take as well. All right, guys, you take care. I'm out here in Woodstock, Georgia. If you're local, happy to help you. If you're not, you can email me and I'm happy to help you, but I'll point you into a direction of somebody who's local because having a mentor near you is way better than trying to do stuff over Zoom. So you can find me, Andy at CrossFit Garage, or on our YouTube channel, Andy McCann 42. All right, y'all take care.
I mostly disagree here because, well, let me be clear what I'm disagreeing with. Medical intervention to lose weight, to me, means gastric band or gastric bypass. Like, if we're talking liposuction or something like that, and you've lost weight, but you're holding fat in a certain area and it just won't go, and otherwise you're healthy, okay, we can talk about that. We're talking about skin removal because you lost so much weight, we can talk about that too, and I'll get to that in a second. I want to talk about just straight up, I'm 300 pounds and I need to be 180 pounds and I'm going to go have my stomach stapled. I am vehemently opposed to this unless it is the only way you're going to get it done and you're risking your health and you're going to die without it. There is a lot of long-term potential complications with this way of eating. And in my opinion, it is going to make eating properly very difficult. Because all it does is restrict your intake. That's all that it does. So what's going to happen is a person on a diet like that is going to have to be on supplementation, and they are going to be eating garbage food that they shouldn't be eating, i.e. carbohydrates. That's what's going to happen. Because you're not going to make, if you made the lifestyle change, you wouldn't need the surgery. So since you don't need the lifestyle change to get the weight now, you're not going to make the lifestyle change, and you're going to continue to eat lesser amounts of crap food and remain continuously in a caloric deficit. The human body was never meant to live that way. You are not designed to live in a permanent caloric deficit. We call that starvation. So while it will reduce weight in people while they're seriously overweight, if they maintain that caloric deficit after the point that they've reached a target weight, their body is now in a state of stress for the rest of their life, and you are biologically not functioning the way a human being is supposed to function. So when I see somebody who's like 450 and climbing, and they break down and do this, I do not say anything negative about them. I'm not going to. But if I could talk to them in advance, I would say at least try to fix it first. If you eat like two meals a day, carnivore, or at least clean keto, you're probably going to have this problem correct itself. There's some advantages here beyond just everything I've said so far. So you know I said about the cellulite or like just some fat hanging in some spot that won't go? It does happen. It's not common, but it does. And if that person chooses lipo, okay, I get it. But there was another surgery that I talked about that some people absolutely need to have done. And that is people that are like, let's say a guy's like 450 pounds. He gets down to 180. And he's really, let's say, at that point he's 200. He's carrying 20 pounds of stretched out skin that just simply won't go away. That skin needs to be surgically removed in that scenario if it works out that way. And you'll see that. These guys like on Extreme Makeover that they used to do, or whatever, Extreme Weight Loss or whatever, that show with that guy, I can't think of his name now, from like network television. You'd see this guy and he's like, he started out at like 396 and now he's like 198. And he gets his hair done and everything for the big reveal. And from he goes from like 198 to 178. And you're like, wow, just in a few last weeks at the end, he lost another 20 pounds. No, he didn't. They cut 20 pounds of freaking skin off his body. There's an interesting dynamic in this. If you will do this with diet, exercise too, sure, but diet is the key. Diet is the driver. What will often happen is because you're spending time in autophagy, that's where the body literally breaks down things it doesn't need anymore and builds new. That's why it extends your life to have autophagy as part of your regular lifestyle. Okay? When you go more than 16 hours without eating, you enter a state of autophagy. And this is where the alleles, which are like literally like an hourglass that says how long you have left to live, on your genes, and literally get longer. This is something until it was researched very recently, it wasn't even known that it could happen. It was thought to be impossible. And as people have started to investigate this style of living, they've seen, and it's not so much just the carnivore keto thing, it's really the intermittent fasting thing, that alleles actually lengthen. That's your biological clock, not like ladies' biological clock to how long you have kids. That's your biological clock until you take a dirt nap. And so, at the same time it will do things like that, your body will literally reuse parts of itself to build anew. So if you have, let's say you're at a weight where you're going to need skin surgery and you lose the weight this way, then you probably won't need skin surgery. I am an example. I was never 400 pounds, right? But I was 300. And I'm like 210, 215 now. And I've been as low as like 205. With that amount of weight loss, you're talking like 95 pounds on a guy my height, and I'm about 5'11". You would expect that I would have like hanging, stretch mark skin. Think about how much a woman's stomach expands to have a baby and the stretch marks that are usually left behind. Okay? That's nowhere near going from 200 to 300. And back down to 200. Like, there should be stretch marks everywhere on my body. they're not there. Because that approach literally took those skin cells, broke them down, and either eliminated them or used them to rebuild new muscle and new tissue. And that is autophagy. So I'm not saying don't. I'm saying last ditch effort only. Try other things first, because the benefits are huge, and the cost and the damage to yourself long term can be catastrophic with some of these interventions. But skin removal, liposuction for that place where, like I said, I'm not talking about the person that's like still 300 pounds and I got liposuction on my ass. I'm talking about the person that's lost the weight and they just have this spot where they won't give up. I get that. All right, moving on. Let's hear about battery banks and battery safety from Sean Mills.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead. And today I've got a question about batteries from Nick. Nick says, what batteries should I use for my battery bank? I just purchased some land and determined that it will be cheaper to build an off-grid system myself than to pay to have power run. I will be putting up a 1200-watt system on the roof of my fifth wheel and want a battery bank of about 600 amp hours. I intend this system to be mobile so that I can have power if I travel with my fifth wheel. For this reason, lithium batteries are tempting because of their size and weight in comparison to the GC2 batteries, which have been my go-to for years. The cost is now roughly the same for equivalent amp hours too, but I'm afraid of my trailer going up in flames like a Tesla or a scooter. I was recently told that the new LFP lithium batteries are far more stable and should be perfectly safe. It's down to 3 LFP batteries or 6 GC2s. All right. Yeah, Nick, this is a good question. So LFP is another acronym for lithium iron phosphate because FE is the symbol for iron. So LFP is like lithium ferrophosphate, or LIFEPO4, LIFEPO4 is another acronym. So, yes, in general, the quick answer is lithium iron phosphate batteries are very stable. They do not have the thermal runaway characteristics that other lithium ion based batteries have. They are very stable, very safe. They are rated for use in the house. Like, there are lithium iron phosphate batteries on the market that are UL rated. I have 6 of them in my bedroom. That's how concerned I am about their safety and whether they're going to burn my house down. Like, I'm literally, you know, if I go to sleep, I'm 10 feet away from a massive battery bank. Now, and I would not do that with GC2 batteries. So there's a couple things to remember. The first one is most fires that are related to solar systems are caused by poor connections. They're caused by a connection that increases the resistance, and that increased resistance essentially creates a heating element. And once that heating element heats up enough to cause combustion, either of the insulation or wood or whatever else is around it, that's where you get fires. Most of the time when you have a remote system, or rather a system that drives around like an RV system, people will put those systems in and then they will not check them. And I tell everyone, I don't care if you're mobile or stationary. When you install a new system, you should be going back and checking your every single connection, every bolt, every nut, every screw, about once a month for the first 6 months, and then at least once a year after that. And if you're mobile with this system, personally, I would check it every time I move. Like, all of that road vibration that you're going to get from going down the road can cause things to loosen up. And those, you know, that loosening, again, can cause your connection to not be as strong as you thought it was. You know, any of these inverters or batteries that come out, they have torque requirements. And the whole point of the torque requirements for those connections is to make sure that you've got a solid connection for the energy flow to work through. So, you know, in general, if you've got the room, if you've got the budget, I would always say lithium iron phosphate. 5 years ago, that wasn't the case, but today it's absolutely the case.
A lot of these inverters now on the market actually have arc fault protection as well as ground fault protection. And so they can actually sense faults on the AC and the DC side and shut themselves off. And that's what you want. You want, when there's a problem, the system to shut itself off. And a lot of people, you know, it causes some consternation because they're like, hey, I was going down the road and I got to where I was going and now my system won't come on. Well, if it was working when you left and it's not working when you got to where you're going, that means a problem happened in route. Sometimes that problem is, you know, you bounced a connection loose inside the inverter and there's nothing to be done about it. But a lot of times it's just the inverter is sensing some sort of current fluctuation that it doesn't like, and it's turning itself off. So always check those connections. And that's the same whether you're using the GC2 flooded lead acid batteries or the lithium iron phosphate batteries. But yeah, the concerns about battery fires are relatively unfounded when it comes to the lithium iron phosphate batteries. You can still have fires because of bad connections. And most of the time when we see like, oh, someone's house burnt down and they just put a solar system in and the fire started at the batteries, it wasn't the battery technology or the battery chemistry that caused the fire. It was a bad connection at the battery, typically on the outside of the battery. And then everyone just defaults to, oh, yeah, remember back during Hurricane Sandy when we saw those electric vehicles exploding and catching fire? Again, different battery technology. So hope that answers your question, sir. You guys keep getting those questions into Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered. Thanks, and have a good one.
Good stuff, as always, from Sean. Now let's move on, and we are going to do something we haven't done in a while. I have a single question. I will go ahead and read it for you in this instance, even though I usually don't, just so that everybody's clear on what's being answered. And then I'm going to play the three segments in a row. Ben and Nick will briefly refresh you on the question a bit, but this way I won't have to talk in the middle. I'm going to play Ben, then Nick's answer, and then my answer, all to the same question, with three different permaculturists, with three different vantage points into this. And I'll admit right up front, I have a little bit of an advantage because Nick didn't get to hear Ben's or my answer, and Ben didn't get to hear Nick's or my answer, but I get to hear both of them before I go, and that will structure a little bit about the way that I'm going to do this. So here we go. Three answers to the same question, kind of a virtual panel on this. The question is as follows. I got out. I am moving to a rural suburb fringe. What are the first things you would do to get your homestead producing when there's no existing infrastructure? I'm moving out to my urban homestead into rural suburban fringe. The house is on 0.67 acres, has zero food producing infrastructure. We'll be bringing in four laying hens, but they're over 2 years old and can only contribute so much. Well, the first things you would do this fall and spring to start getting some production out of our new homestead, we will expand our laying for hawk and spring, so I need to get an adequate coop built. I'm thinking about meat chickens, quail, or rabbits, but that's too much to take on right away. I hope that some neighbors who have deer huntable land will be friendly enough to grant me access. Garlic is going in this fall, possible blueberry bushes and raspberries. The house is built into a hill, but the backyard is mostly flat with some maple oak trees along the edges to provide various microclimates. I appreciate the work that you do. Hopefully, you are correct about short economic respite before it all hits the fan. That way, I can get my family set up with more self-sufficiency. With that, let's hear from Ben, then Nick, then me.
Hey, Jack and all. Ben Falk with Whole Systems Design. The question about first priorities for food producing values and self-sufficiency on 2/3 of an acre. I'm going to assume you're in a temperate climate because you said oaks and maples. And I'm going to assume the backyard is pretty sunny. It sounds like it is. If it's not, your first priority of business is cutting trees back. You need, on this size, as much of your yard to be sunny as possible. And when I say sunny, I mean like full sun, 8+ hours a day or more, depending on just how temperate you are. So the first thing I'd mention is that chickens, meat birds, laying hens, that's not self-sufficient food. For the most part, that's just food processing because you have a grain dependence. Speaking of chickens, my rooster's right over here. we don't feed our chickens grain in the summer, but they still get a lot of grain throughout the rest of the year. They're not food production in the way a cow eating grass is food production, or in the way potatoes are food production. Going to get a deer is food production. That's actually you're getting food without any to minimal inputs. With chickens, you could just eat the grain. If you're going to grow the grain for them, you might as well eat the grain. It's a bigger win from just a self-sufficiency standpoint. Now, I'm not saying you don't need protein and aren't getting a higher value yield than just eating grain, for sure, but there's still a total dependency, off-site dependency there. So I wouldn't focus on chickens really at all. I would see them as a supplement, not a core actual food production. So your core actual food production, and again, that's a caveat, unless you're in the compost slash bug business or you're in the tropics, like that's pretty much how it works with birds that are going to be fat enough to warrant slaughtering or really going to make much in the way of eggs. So second one, garlic, great. That's nice health crop, but it's also not a calorie and staple crop. I would focus on potatoes, squash, corn, beans, probably in that order, roughly, somewhat climate dependent. The drier it is, the further back potatoes would probably go on that list, and the more beans might come to the fore. But if you're going to grow a lot of food, you're going to need good soil, which means you're going to first need a lot of organic matter. So your first order of business is getting a place for wood chips and manure to be dumped. It sounds like you're in an area where hopefully it's not so rural that you can get a bunch of those. So you need a place that's easy to access, where you can beg, borrow, bribe people to dump, especially wood chips. But if you can get manure from like a grass-fed operation, ideally, all the better as well. Same with any organic matter that you can get that's not contaminated. Grass clippings, green glass clippings, again, from a yard that's not sprayed, ideally. Raking leaves as much as you possibly can. You need to get your compost operation going. Stat, you need to make as much soil as you possibly can. You're going to need it to turn it into food. Second order business is to do your bed prep. So you're probably going to be broad forking any beds you want to use next year. I'd broad fork them right now within a week or two. I'd tilt them slash till them the top layer. And then I would sow buckwheat anywhere I wanted to grow next year. I would do that all before mid-August, again, depending on your climate, because you want the buckwheat to get up. That'll winter kill, depending on your climate. Again, if you're temperate, it should winter kill. You rake it back, you have a great seed bed for next year. You're going to end up putting your compost on top of that that you've made in the meantime this summer, fall, maybe a little next spring. And then I would just start simple. Just focus on those crops. It sounds like there's an economic self-sufficiency motivation here and you have a family to feed. So I would get serious and just focus on those things. Not that I wouldn't grow some salad greens. I mean, health is important too. Tomatoes and stuff like that. But that's all bonus. You know, that's all gravy. If like you're just trying to get fed, you got to think about like a peasant garden and that climate around the world and what it looks like. And it's pretty much corn, beans, and squash. You know, in the longer run, sure, establish a few nut trees on the northern end of your woods. But at this scale, you know, that's really where you're going to be. You're going to get the most calories out of your system. You could get fancy and do some things like maybe a little bit of aquaculture down the road from roof rainwater. But that's all like high input infrastructure. It doesn't hit the self-sufficiency pieces because there's usually pumps and a lot of materials involved. Not that it's not an option. I also might focus on a place to extend your season right off the bat, like build a greenhouse this summer, fall, winter, depending on your climate again. But you know, the more you can extend your season, the better. And then you need a food storage place. You need a place, you need a root cellar of some kind. It could be a clamp in the ground, but ideally it's part of a full basement, where you can retrofit it into a root cellar with just some passive ventilation. There's a lot of other ideas out there. There's a lot of other needs, but those, if you're just trying to keep it simple, are where I'd start. I might also make raised beds if you have the means to get some like 2x10s of lumber, even if it's pine. Doesn't have to be hemlock or anything special, because those will give you the most results for the least amount of effort, and you can just fill them with good compost as you have them. But you got to get the organic matter on hand. You got to start listening for chips. You got to call up all the arborists in your area, and you need to get the piles of organic matter and compost rolling. At this early stage, too, I would also focus on gleaning and bulk buying and things that actually aren't food production. If self-sufficiency is your goal, reducing economic inputs, having affordability is your goal, and just feeding your family as cheaply as possible is your goal, I would think it's a win to make sure you have a big, efficient chest freezer, again, cool storage, and especially in these first few years, realize you're probably going to get further economically and self-sufficiency-wise to actually buy slash trade for slash glean bulk storage food crops of all kinds from local farms, and hunting and gleaning on the hunting and you know, wild meat end, and being able to store it, just focus on being able to have a place to put it for at least, you know, 4 to 8 months a year, then I would be focusing on actually producing it yourself. Of course, the first part of my answer is all about production, but really, if you were to measure out the economic advantages here, you might get 2, 3, 4x further along by just focusing on how to get stuff locally cheap in bulk and being able to store it on site. Lot more opportunities here, but at this scale, at this stage in the game, at the very beginning, you got to really just prioritize and keep it simple and do what you're doing really well at the beginning. Then you can expand and get more multifaceted as you go. Good luck to you and congrats.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Michael on first things for a homestead. Hi, Jack. I got out. I'm moving to the rural suburb fringe. What are the first things you would do to get your homestead producing when there's no existing infrastructure? First, my gut response is going to probably come as no surprise to members of the audience who've known me for the last decade: fodder trees. Why? Because it's easy to store emergency food in the form of rice and beans, but meat is expensive. So rather than spend your valuable space growing carrots, use it to grow the most valuable dietary component you can: fat and protein. Honestly, I design out my backyard with fodder tree rows spaced, I don't know, about 10 foot apart to leave yourself, you know, 4 to 6 foot of space between the rows to tractor small stock or grow in raised beds. The fodder trees would be trimmed to around waist height, so you're going to have room and sunlight to grow stuff in between those. You could use that space between the rows of trees for raised beds, in-ground garden beds, or basically like a yard pasture to tractor birds or small meat animals like rabbits or guinea pigs. The entire space could be used, that whole backyard, for instance, could be used as a pen for the chickens to forage under the fodder tree rows if you devote the whole space to meat production. So, depending on orientation and solar aspect, you could even include some solar panels in there. I'd probably go with vertical bifacial panels, but standard panels would work fine as well. You just want to ground mount them with enough height to walk underneath them. You could farm high protein yields to produce meat in the yard through the fodder leaves and forbs for growing between the rows in the form of grass, clover, comfrey, and so on and so forth. And you could stack functions with some PV panels in the same space. Then you can grow any of your other food needs elsewhere on the property, like the front yard and side yards, depending on how the property is laid out. Some of the most important needs to meet are producing a little of your own power and producing meat and fat. Yeah, sure, those smaller stock don't make very much fat, like rabbits. Everyone talks about rabbit starvation, but when you really look at the amount of fat that domestic rabbits produce, it's not like wild rabbits. They do produce some fat. Every little bit counts. And on a half an acre, there is still a freaking lot you can do to produce at least some of your needs. You can produce a whole heck of a lot more than you think. I'd seriously consider adding some black soldier fly bins, 1 to 4, to help process waste streams and produce a ton of high quality fat and protein to feed your birds. If you get good with those insects and can produce enough through summertime dehydration and storage of the excess of those grubs, you can even get self-sufficient with quail on your property. That's a massive bonus, simply for the fat that those birds can put on. So, yeah, I mean, I'd focus on the things you need to have done that will reduce routine expenses, and especially the ones that take a few years to get into good production, like fodder trees. If you're thinking about this from the perspective of, hey, you know, the stink might be hitting the fan in the next 5 or so years. Well, now is the time to really be doubling down on the infrastructure, the things that are going to make it easy and profitable and possible for you to raise meat and fat. Those are the things that are going to make the most difference. Those are going to move the needle the furthest. So, hope that helps. I've got some consults lined up, but I still have a slot for Northern Arkansas or Southern Missouri for September 3rd if someone is interested on my way back home from visiting my family. Maybe one near Fargo around the 25th or 26th of August. And I am still planning on a trip to South Carolina sometime in September-ish. So I'll be all over the southeastern states. I've probably got a couple stops in Tennessee and Georgia and who knows where else. With that said, I'm Nick Ferguson with Homegrown Liberty, traveling the USA, helping homesteaders like you design robust systems to feed your families. Do good things.
So totally different approaches, which is awesome. I think that's a great way to look into this. You got one that's very meat, protein, fat centric, and let's grow food for the animals. And you got one that's very, let's grow carbohydrate crops for the human. And we get the first approach from Ben, hey, you're not really going to be able on that much land grow enough food to do a lot of meat production, thinking from a standpoint of feeding the animal grain. And then you got Nick, and Nick comes around and says, well, if we feed the quail and the chickens, you know, black soldier fly larvae, we can grow tons, and you literally can. Now, here's the thing. It's situationally dependent. How far north is this property? Ben assumes it's temperate. Ben assumes it's a lot like his. I don't even know if you get black soldier flies in southern Vermont. I'm not sure. I know they're pretty much across most of the country, but they do need a certain amount of heat. So I'm not sure if that is as valid a play that far north. So is this person in Virginia or is this person in Maine? That would change things. But either way, both of those approaches can be modified to work. We could bring in some things like aquaculture. As long as you're more than 2 foot in the ground, you're not going to freeze solid. And so if you're in a place where you can easily go 3 foot with a rubber liner in the ground, you've got a pond, you got a whole new layer of production. You can have a pond in the ground, and we'll save these thoughts for later for my anchor segment, but we could have multiple tanks that return back. Those can be grow-out tanks, production tanks, just overall health of the system tanks, aquaponics tanks, whatever you want them to be during the main part of the year. It's going to freeze, yes, and so what's going to happen is then you're going to put the sump, the lowest point in the system that's below the ground, on some sort of a pump that's just simple, like a fountain pump, to keep it from freezing solid. And even if that freezes up, your cold water, your fish that are still in the pond at that point, you should harvest a lot of fish at that point, you know, as you're going into your winter, so that you don't have it overpopulated. But the ones that are in there are going to produce very little waste. You're not going to feed them when it's frozen. You shut the pump off, and they'll just sit there and wait for the pond to thaw out. As long as it's big enough, you know, something in the 800-gallon range, which is 3 foot deep, you're not going to have any trouble doing that. very inexpensively. So there's all these techniques, and I'm giving you more techniques, and I'm about to shift gears. See, my question would be, what do you want? What do you want? What is your strategy? See, everything that we've talked about, and I get the advantage of going last here, and I planned it that way. Everything we have done here has focused around technique and tactic. And we haven't really focused on strategy, though both of those segments from Nick and Ben and mine up to this point have been strategy based on what we would do. I have this strategy, so I will create this assemblage of techniques and tactics. Great. But what if your strategy doesn't match the strategy that is right for your client? Stepping as a consultant into this, and I'm sure Ben and Nick would both take this approach if they were handling this as a client relationship. They're giving examples based on what they can intuit from this side of it. But if I'm a consultant, or if Ben or Nick were a consultant going in and talking to this person, let's sit down and let's imagine that we wave a wand and let's not talk about the way everything looks yet. What comes out? What's the production? What is most important to you? And if the important to you is fresh fruits and vegetables, you're going to look more like, not only like, but more like Ben's approach. If it's meat, protein, fat, right, it's going to look more like Nick's, and it's probably going to have elements of both, but we have to figure that out first. Now, I very recently did an episode that went deep into this, so I'm going to shorten my talk today on this by recommending you check it out if you didn't listen to it when it came out. Came out on June 26, episode 3514, 3514. It was called The Suburban Backyard Homestead. And I go through interviewing yourself and asking yourself questions like, do you eat meat? Do you want to care for animals that must be killed to utilize them? What fruits and vegetables do you eat? Not do you think you can grow. Do you actually like to eat? Do you eat eggs? Do you eat fish? How much time do you have? Do you travel? Like, you need to, in this instance, need to interview yourself like you're your own consultant. And you need to treat yourself like a client. And this is one thing that you have to do as a consultant. And I don't like doing it. It's part of why I don't like consulting. You have to not let your client bullshit you. When you say to your client, how many hours a week do you want to work in your backyard homestead? And they say 20, you have to immediately go, bullshit, it's 10. I'm sorry. It just, when they say 10, it's 5. You just cut it in half. You cut it in half, you build the system to meet half of what they said, and they will be able to maintain it if they choose to. And they still might not. Because, you know what, 20 hours a week in October sounds pretty nice. 20 hours a week here in August sounds like a way to kill yourself. So you have to take all of this stuff into account. First, define the strategy. I want a homestead that does the following 10 things really well. Now, what techniques and tactics, and how do I stack permaculture principles into that design to get to that end? Because I would be way more toward Nick's side of things. I would personally bring aquaculture into it because I don't think anything is productive per square foot as aquaculture is. I would grow things that are less a carbohydrate yield and more of an adjunctive yield. So I'm going to grow things in my aquatic system, like water spinach, which is Ipomoea aquatica. That's an edible for me. It's an edible for my animals. I'm going to grow water hyacinth. I'm not really going to... You can eat it. It's not that great. But that is going to be a food yield. So with just those two, I can make high-protein feed for my chickens if I'm willing... What's your investment potential? I would make sure you can get the production out of that, but you could take something like a little bit of comfrey, water hyacinth, azolla, water spinach, yeah, okay, dry all that out, get entry-level but commercial-quality pelletizer and a hammer mill, and you can store up enough feed for your poultry just with that, as supplemental feed to get through your winter, along with something like your black soldier fly law. Should you do that? I have no idea. See, and the problem is we get people that, and I'm not putting anybody down, I'm just saying we get people to ask this question. There's 1,000 versions of this question that I've had over 16 years, but it's all the same thing. What should I do with my half acre, with my 1 acre, with my 3 acres? And the first thing we have to figure out is what you want. And once you want, we know what you want. Now we can design. And the person did the best job they could of explaining that, but you're also at a point where you really don't know what you want yet. You just know you want the hell out, which you did, congratulations, and you know that the results you want need to be somewhere toward food self-sufficiency. I think both Ben and Nick gave you fantastic ideas for that. I'll tell you something I know about Ben. He does not drive past the deer that's hit on the road without checking it. And that is probably the most sustainable meat on the planet, even if it's a little bit illegal. Like, it turns out it's illegal in Texas to pick a deer up off the road. Pennsylvania, when I was lived up there, you could make a phone call to a game warden, and they'd either give you a tag number over the phone, or they'd come out and actually check it if they were in the area, and then you could take the deer. In Texas, you can't even do it. But I found something out here. No police officer is going to write you. They don't even have a code to cite you with. There's no ticket for them to write. They don't have jurisdiction over it. They could write you something like endangering traffic or something. That's about it. And they don't do it. I've now picked up deer and had a cop help me put it in the back of my truck. I asked my brother-in-law, who's a cop here, what he thought. He said, no cop's going to do that. No cop's going to do that because they're like, now I don't have to deal with it. Right? So unless the rabbit sheriff's around, you ain't got to worry. So that's like an incredibly sustainable protein yield. Gleaning, foraging, etc. That Ben was mentioning all that. Absolutely. But Nick's right. I can grow a carrot, or I can get carrots really, really cheap, even organic ones, and I can grow food for my food. You have to determine what you want. Somebody who eats a lot of potatoes and sweet potatoes and other carbohydrate crops and vegetables and fruits, you should go all in intensive on building your fertility for that. If you're producing animals, you're going to build plenty of fertility for sideline and margin growing as well. In fact, you may be able to produce enough fertility that eventually you actually do begin to export fertility. And you would export the fertility at that point only because you just really don't have any place for it anymore. And then that's an income stream. That's a barter item. And now we get into a whole new level of things. So it sounds like in that urban-rural fringe, you may have a lot of opportunity to work with neighbors. Anyway, with that, like I said, I did get the benefit of going last, which is always where I want to go on a panel, is last. Next up, let's hear about some bad gas. It's probably bad anyway. 2-year-old gas from Eric Hammond. So totally different approaches, which is awesome. I think that's a great way to look into this. You got one that's very meat, protein, fat-centric, and let's grow food for the animals. And you got one that's very, let's grow carbohydrate crops for the human. And we get the first approach from Ben, hey, you're not really going to be able, on that much land, grow enough food to do a lot of meat production, thinking from a standpoint of feeding the animal grain. And then you got Nick, and Nick comes around and says, well, if we feed the quail and the chickens, you know, black soldier fly larvae, we can grow tons, and you literally can. Now, here's the thing. It's situationally dependent. How far north is this property? Ben assumes it's temperate. Ben assumes it's a lot like his. I don't even know if you get black soldier flies in southern Vermont. I'm not sure. I know they're pretty much across most of the country, but they do need a certain amount of heat. So I'm not sure if that is as valid a play that far north. So is this person in Virginia or is this person in Maine? That would change things. But either way, both of those approaches can be modified to work. We could bring in some things like aquaculture. As long as you're more than 2 foot in the ground, you're not going to freeze solid. And so if you're in a place where you can easily go 3 foot with a rubber liner in the ground, you've got a pond, you got a whole new layer of production. You can have a pond in the ground, and we'll save these thoughts for later for my anchor segment, but we could have multiple tanks that return back. Those can be grow-out tanks, production tanks, just overall health of the system tanks, aquaponics tanks, whatever you want them to be during the main part of the year. It's going to freeze, yes, and so what's going to happen is then you're going to put the sump, the lowest point in the system that's below the ground, on some sort of a pump that's just simple, like a fountain pump, to keep it from freezing solid. And even if that freezes up, your cold water, your fish that are still in the pond at that point, you should harvest a lot of fish at that point, you know, as you're going into your winter, so that you don't have it overpopulated. But the ones that are in there are going to produce very little waste. You're not going to feed them when it's frozen. You shut the pump off, and they'll just sit there and wait for the pond to thaw out. As long as it's big enough, you know, something in the 800-gallon range, which is 3 foot deep, you're not going to have any trouble doing that very inexpensively. So there's all these techniques, and I'm giving you more techniques, and I'm about to shift gears. See, my question would be, What do you want? What do you want? What is your strategy? See, everything that we've talked about, and I get the advantage of going last here, and I planned it that way. Everything we have done here has focused around technique and tactic, and we haven't really focused on strategy, though both of those segments from Nick and Ben and mine up to this point have been strategy based on what we would do. I have this strategy, so I will create this assemblage of techniques and tactics. Great. But what if your strategy doesn't match the strategy that is right for your client? Stepping as a consultant into this, and I'm sure Ben and Nick would both take this approach if they were handling this as a client relationship. They're giving examples based on what they can intuit from this side of it. But if I'm a consultant, or if Ben or Nick were a consultant going in and talking to this person, let's sit down and let's imagine that we wave a wand and let's not talk about the way everything looks yet. What comes out? What's the production? What is most important to you? And if the important to you is fresh fruits and vegetables, you're going to look more like, not only like, but more like Ben's approach. If it's meat, protein, fat, right, it's going to look more like Nick's, and it's probably going to have elements of both, but we have to figure that out first. Now, I very recently did an episode that went deep into this, so I'm going to shorten my talk today on this by recommending you check it out if you didn't listen to it when it came out. It came out on June 26th, episode 3514, 3514. It was called The Suburban Backyard Homestead. And I go through interviewing yourself and asking yourself questions like, do you eat meat? Do you want to care for animals that must be killed to utilize them? What fruits and vegetables do you eat? Not do you think you can grow. Do you actually like to eat? Do you eat eggs? Do you eat fish? How much time do you have? Do you travel? Like, you need to, in this instance, need to interview yourself like you're your own consultant, and you need to treat yourself like a client. And this is one thing that you have to do as a consultant, and I don't like doing it. It's part of why I don't like consulting. You have to not let your client bullshit you. When you say to your client, how many hours a week do you want to work in your backyard homestead, and they say 20, you have to immediately go, bullshit, it's 10. I'm sorry. It just, when they say 10, it's 5. You just cut it in half. You cut it in half, you build the system to meet half of what they said, and they will be able to maintain it if they choose to. And they still might not. Because, you know what, 20 hours a week in October sounds pretty nice. 20 hours a week here in August sounds like a way to kill yourself. So you have to take all of this stuff into account. First, define the strategy. I want a homestead that does the following 10 things really well. Now, what techniques and tactics, and how do I stack permaculture principles into that design to get to that end? Because I would be way more toward Nick's side of things. I would personally bring aquaculture into it, because I don't think anything is productive per square foot as aquaculture is. I would grow things that are less a carbohydrate yield and more of an adjunctive yield. So I'm going to grow things in my aquatic system, like water spinach, which is Ipomoea aquatica. That's an edible for me. It's an edible for my animals. I'm going to grow water hyacinth. I'm not really going to... You can eat it. It's not that great. But that is going to be a food yield. So with just those two, I can make high protein feed for my chickens if I'm willing... What's your investment potential? I would make sure you can get the production out of that, but you could take something like a little bit of comfrey, water hyacinth, azolla, water spinach, yeah, okay, dry all that out, get entry-level but commercial quality pelletizer and a hammer mill, and you can store up enough feed for your poultry just with that, as supplemental feed to get through your winter, along with something like your black soldier fly law. Should you do that? I have no idea. See, and the problem is we get people, and I'm not putting anybody down, I'm just saying we get people to ask this question. There's 1,000 versions of this question that I've had over 16 years, but it's all the same thing. What should I do with my half acre, with my 1 acre, with my 3 acres? And the first thing we have to figure out is what you want. And once you want, we know what you want. Now we can design. And the person did the best job they could of explaining that. But you're also at a point where you really don't know what you want yet. You just know you want the hell out, which you did, congratulations, and you know that the results you want need to be somewhere toward food self-sufficiency. I think both Ben and Nick gave you fantastic ideas for that. I'll tell you something I know about Ben. He does not drive past the deer that's hit on the road without checking it. And that is probably the most sustainable meat on the planet, even if it's a little bit illegal. Like, it turns out it's illegal in Texas to pick a deer up off the road. Pennsylvania, when I was lived up there, you could make a phone call to a game warden, and they'd either give you a tag number over the phone, or they'd come out and actually check it if they were in the area, and then you could take the deer. In Texas, you can't even do it. But I found something out here. No police officer is going to write you. They don't even have a code to cite you with. There's no ticket for them to write. They don't have jurisdiction over it. They could write you something like endangering traffic or something. That's about it. And they don't do it. I've now picked up deer and had a cop help me put it in the back of my truck. I asked my brother-in-law, who's a cop here, what he thought. He said, no cop's going to do that. No cop's going to do that because they're like, now I don't have to deal with it. Right? So unless the rabbit sheriff's around, you ain't got to worry. So that's like an incredibly sustainable protein yield. Gleaning, foraging, etc. That Ben was mentioning all that. Absolutely. But Nick's right. I can grow a carrot, or I can get carrots really, really cheap, even organic ones, and I can grow food for my food. You have to determine what you want. If somebody who eats a lot of potatoes and sweet potatoes and other carbohydrate crops and vegetables and fruits, you should go all in intensive on building your fertility for that. If you're producing animals, you're going to build plenty of fertility for sideline and margin growing as well. In fact, you may be able to produce enough fertility that eventually you actually do begin to export fertility. And you would export the fertility at that point only because you just really don't have any place for it anymore. And then that's an income stream. That's a barter item. And now we get into a whole new level of things. So it sounds like in that urban-rural fringe, you may have a lot of opportunity to work with neighbors. Anyway, with that, like I said, I did get the benefit of going last, which is always where I want to go on a panel is last. Next up, let's hear about some bad gas. It's probably bad anyway. 2-year-old gas from Eric Hammond.
Greetings, Eric Hammond with another Expert Counsel segment. A listener wrote in and said that his father has just given him 2 red gas cans full of gas and have been sitting outside underneath a shelf for 2+ years untreated. He wants to know if the gas is still good, how can he tell, and then if it's not good, how does he get rid of it? 2 years is a pretty long time for questionable storage methods, so we're just going to approach this like it probably is bad. So I'm going to give you how you should do it, a couple ways to do it from home, one that's kind of questionable, and then I'm going to stay away from anything that is completely dangerous and leave that to other people. So you should probably call your local county. Just type your county name plus hazmat, or you can call the landfill and ask them about hazmat, and they will be able to hook you up with the people that will take this and dispose of it for you. It actually will cost you money. It's probably going to cost you more per gallon to dispose of it that way than it to actually buy the fluid to begin with. But any contaminated gasoline, gas mixed with diesel, diesel mixed with diesel exhaust fluid, it's a hazardous material, but your county should have a hazmat resource for that and can point you in the right direction. If you want to get rid of this at home, so let's take this gas can that we have. You know, if it has a cap on the nozzle and the nozzle's clean, that's good, but a lot of times those caps are missing. So take the nozzle off, clean that nozzle really good. They get spider webs and mud daubers and everything else in there. Clean it with compressed air. If you don't have that, you could clean it with water, but make sure it's dry when you put it back on there. Look inside the can, see if you see anything in there, and then you're going to put the nozzle on and get a clear plastic jug, or, you know, you could use a glass mason jar if you had to, but like, this is flammable stuff, you got to be careful with it. Invert the jug completely and then pour gasoline into the clear container, and we're going to see what's inside of it. So one of the things is water sinks to the bottom of gasoline floats to the top, so you're not going to see it if you just peek in the jug. But if I flip this container over completely and I pour what's in there out, you're going to see if there's any water in there and then some of the contaminants that may be at the bottom. And then you're going to look at it. You know, gasoline should be kind of clear, should be kind of yellowish. It shouldn't smell terrible. You don't be huffing it, but like, smell what it smells like. Does it smell like paint thinner? Because that could be bad. If it passes all those tests and it looks okay, it doesn't have anything in it, and it doesn't smell too bad, you know, if you had an older vehicle, like say something from the 90s, I would not be opposed to you trying to burn this in a dilution situation. So fill up the vehicle completely with fuel and then add like say a gallon of this to it and see what happens. And if that goes okay for that tank, you know, add 2 gallons the next time and see if you can't just burn it all away. See, it will probably mix readily with it and then you'll be good. I don't know how much of a quantity you actually have. You know, 2 gas jugs could be anywhere from 2 gallons to 10 gallons. That I would do that if I had a large quantity. If I had a small quantity and I wanted to get rid of it and I didn't have a, you know, an older vehicle to put this in, one of the ways you can get rid of it is like, say, you do your own oil changes. You could take and dilute some of the oil you return to the parts store, the used oil, with gasoline. So typically you change your oil, you got this jug full of 5 quarts of used motor oil, you take it to the parts store and then they recycle that oil for you. So you could take and pour, you know, a quart of gasoline in that used oil and recycle it a little bit at a time. That could take a while to get rid of, so if you had a large quantity, that may not be a good option for you. But it's pretty typical with gasoline engines, like you're going to get gasoline in the crankcase just from normal combustion. That's the way it works. But you know, lawnmowers and tractors and things, or a float can stick in a carburetor, it could fill the crankcase full of fuel. So it's pretty typical for fuel to be mixed with oil. That's something they see all the time. That wouldn't throw any red flags. That's not doing anything illegal. I would just do it a little bit at a time and that would get rid of it. The last one I'm gonna give you that's like borderline, you probably shouldn't do this, gray area. If you have like say a 5 gallon jug of this and it is contaminated with stuff, you poured the container out and you looked at it and it's just full of sludge and grit and nasty stuff, and you just don't know how to get rid of a large quantity, you know, you could put this in a bucket or, you know, a tray. You'd have to be really careful. It's highly volatile. But like say you accidentally spilled some on like a cookie tray, you know, and then you go to get rags to clean it up, but like by the time you come back, like it's all gone. Like I'm not really sure what happened to it, but it disappeared. You know, the quantity of it could be reduced that way till you got down to something manageable like a quart, and then you could just dispose of the quart just like we talked about a little bit ago. Once you get the containers cleaned, you could mix a little bit of fresh gas in the container to completely wash it out, dispose of it how we've talked about, and then you got 2 good gas cans ready to go. Make sure, you know, one of the things with storing these cans outside that I'm really bad about is like raindrops get in the spout and then you get water in the gas can. So if you just take like a nitrile glove, like a used one, and cut the fingertips off of them, you can just take those fingertips and put them right over the gas nozzle tip, and that'll keep water and spiders and everything else out. I hope that helps you. If anybody else has any questions, gasoline, diesel, electric, 2-stroke, 4-stroke, whatever, if it's interesting and it's broke and it should work but it doesn't, give me a crack at answering it. Thanks.
So I'll just say I have gotten rid of old gas that would be a bit sketchy with what I call the dilution technique, which just is like, for every 10 gallons that goes in the vehicle, you use 0.5 gallon. And go ahead and treat it as though you were treating bad gas, you know, with water in it, in case that's happened, with the proper treatment based on the instructions of the product that you choose to use. And you could probably use it all. I wouldn't dump 5 gallons of it in my car. But if I went to the gas station and my car was full, I drove home, I used about 0.5 gallon, I would dump 0.5 gallon in, and I wouldn't worry about it. I know that sounds crazy, but I've done it. I've done it with gas that, like, I literally put the gas in a small engine and I had to drain the engine because it was just not running well. And then when you dilute it, it runs fine. Just now. I don't know if you want to take it. I've done it with gas that's like a year old and it's not complete shit yet. So I don't know if you want to try that with gas that's that old. And then there's always just, you know, store it safely and use it for starting fires until you're out of it. I mean, it is kind of one of those hazmat situations. Anyway, let's go ahead and talk about something totally different. I have a question from someone. I'm going to go ahead and read it for you. It has a diagram. There's really no way for me to present that to you when I'm doing audio only. I can upload the diagram. It's pretty crude, but it does the job, I think. Here's the question. Jack, if you were connecting several stock tank ponds together in line level ground to a lower sump, would you pump all the water to just the furthest tank so that it must circulate through the whole system, or would you pump water to every tank at once so they all get good aeration? My tank is flat, and my stock tanks are 300-gallon Rubbermaid tanks. I'd rather use bigger Hastings tanks, but I already have five of these sitting on the ground. The sump is going to be 100-gallon tanks. Thank you, Steven, in San Angelo, Tejas. Okay, Steven, where I just go... You should use what I would call a manifold approach to this. Is straight up that all three of the tanks that are higher level tanks that are going to act as return tanks, pitch and throw return tanks, right? These are my terms I've made up because I've never seen anybody really dig into this and explain it, so I have to make my own shit up. So a manifold delivery is exactly what you described, that each tank would have its own delivery from the pressurized water. And the way that I do this in my systems is with, like, it's basically you're building a manifold. You're using T's and elbows and end caps, and you're going to make a point at each tank where the water returns to that tank individually. And you're going to use a swing valve, a ball valve, call it what you want to, slip and slip valve. And the reason I like slip and slip is it's really easy to put a little piece of pipe on the output side if you need to, because situations are different. If you don't put that little piece of pipe on there to, like, control the flow, you're going to get much more of an erratic return, which gives you a lot of disturbance, which you might want. You also may not want it. It all depends on what you're doing with the tank that the water is going into. I encourage you to look at some of my videos on aquatics and use, if you want to grow surface vegetation, use something I call air stacks. It's just another piece of pipe that goes down to the bottom of that tank, and your return line goes into that, and it's got some holes drilled in it, and that way it can aerate, but it doesn't tumble over your surface vegetation, which you probably want in San Angelo, Texas. It's even hotter than me. The beauty of surface vegetation, especially in your summer, which is when you're going to have most of it, is it reduces evaporation, it keeps the water cooler, which is going to be really important when you only have a 100-gallon sump, and you've got 900 gallons above grade. So I'm going to throw in a bonus here, which is something you didn't ask about. This thing needs to be shaded. Black tanks above grade in San Angelo in the summer need to be in shade, or you're going to have a system that's 110-degree water. That's what you will eventually end up with, because you're going to get almost no mitigating cooling effect from the sump. There is no reason mechanically... You can't build this system, three above-ground tanks, 100-gallon sump, and pitch and throw return. None. Because when you set everything, you're not going to ever put more water into the sump than it can handle. Unless you mess something up. Which could. And this is my thing. Your sump is your battery. Okay? Your sump is your battery. I'm going to say it one more time. Your sump is your battery. Now, you're building an electrical system instead of an aquatic one. I have battery A, and it is size 50. Doesn't even matter what that means. 50 amps, whatever. It's a reserve capacity of 50. And I have battery B, and it's a reserve capacity of 300. Which battery do you want? Oh, I want the bigger. Unless it's a weight issue, like in a car or something, and 50's enough, you want the biggest battery you can get. Okay, when we bury a tank in the ground, weight is not an issue. So, I understand using what you have. I'm all for using what you have. I would seriously consider getting something like a 6-foot round stock tank, plastic or metal. Metal costs less, plastic is better, and using it as your sump. If you do that, you're going to have more capacity in the sump than you do in the 300-gallon, the three 300-gallon tanks, individually anyway. It's about 6-foot by 2-foot circle tank is around 470-gallon capacity. Obviously, you're going to be using about 450 gallons of capacity. Your 300-gallon Rubbermaid, you're going to be using about 280 because you're not. You always want to leave freeboard. So that, on a straight level, is the way I would do it. Your idea, and again, I'll put his diagram on my server with a link next to this bullet point if anybody wants to look at it. It looks in the diagram like it's a slant, but he says specifically that it is a level surface. And level is beautiful. And I would still, with your individual delivery, I would still plumb the tanks together. Those can be through your return lines. Those can be through bulkheads connecting them. And I would plumb them together, okay? And I would still bridge all three tanks. So do we need two bridges to do this with something called an aquarium siphon? An aquarium siphon is super simple to build. You need three pieces of PVC pipe, one piece long enough to easily span the gap between the two tanks. The other two pieces need to be the same length and long enough to go, let's say, 50% the depth of the tank, of the water depth of the tank. Not the whole tank, just the water depth. That gives you a lot of redundancy. You stick them together. You can do them all by friction. You pound them together with a rubber mallet if you have any kind of vacuum problems, if you're not getting a good seal. They don't need to be glued. That way they can always be reused. Turn them upside down. You fill them up. And in one motion, you just flip them over into the tank and it bridges. It creates an aquarium siphon. What that means is if side A starts to drop, then side B will start shedding water to it until they equalize. And this way you have your bulkheaded or plumbed capacity for sharing water like a single tank. Plus you have a second. You have two is one and one is none. So if one clogs or whatever, you have a redundancy. Those aquarium siphons is what they're called. Okay? Those guys can fail over time. They can get gas buildup inside them and whatever. So about once a month on my systems that use them, I go out, I pull them out, I put them upside down, fill them up with water, flip them back over. I don't know if I have a video on how these things work, but if I don't find one, I will make one and release it this weekend so that people could, because this is a good skill I learned from my buddy David. Really super simple how to do that. Okay, now, the other approach he's talking, I call it a cascading return, meaning I have tank A, B, and C, and then sump is D. Water pumps out of D, goes to A, overflows A to B, overflows C, B to C, then overflows C to D. The beauty of this is I throw one time, that means I can use less total pressure from a pump. I can use a smaller pump, lower draw. I only get to go water to go one place, not three or four. It goes into that top tank and cascades down. If you want to do that, I've done it one place, it works perfectly. Here's what you need to do. One, the biggest return lines that will work for you that you can afford. I use 2-inch. I'm glad I didn't use 1.5. I said a long time ago, and I will continue to say this, nobody ever says, gee, I wish my return lines were smaller. Often people say, gee, I wish my return lines were bigger. So the bigger the pipe, the more expensive, and the more of a pain in the ass it is to fit it together because it doesn't bend, right? 3-inch pipe doesn't bend. 2-inch pipe doesn't bend. 3-inch pipe laughs at you if you think you're going to bend it, right? It just doesn't give. So you do have a little bit more work to do, but you only do it once. And so I would go minimum 2-inch return lines for everything is what I do from now on. Your situation, I would probably do it 2-inch, but I wouldn't do less. I would not do less. The 300-gallon Rubbermaids, they're plumbed with, I think, like a 3/4-inch. I would drill them out and put my own bulkheads in for the pipes. And in his diagram, he has the pipes up really high. I would put the pipes down low. Okay, and I'd put my overflow apparatus would help set the level. You can set the level with how high the overflow apparatus is or how high the other end coming out is. Unless you're going to create a stair-step down method with your cascade, don't do it. If all three tanks are going to be on the same level, trust me, I've done this, deliver individually. If you can step down 6 inches per tank, which probably won't work for you based on what you're telling me, and that's the one, I have one that cascades through four. You don't really get much more water disturbance. Because in the three-tank system, you get three deliveries, that's three disturbances, one return, that's four. Same scenario, if you get one disturbance on delivery, the pump pushing water is a disturbance, then when you get that times three and you have a common return, that's four. It's the same number. It just takes more pump to feed three locations or four locations than one. Now, I'm running a Danner pump, which is my standard pump. I'm actually trialing a new one right now, but for now, Danner's still my standard pump. It's like a 2,900 gallon per hour, and I'm delivering from one of those three tanks in a manifold and one in a cascade, and more capacity than I need to do that. So it's not really that big a deal. I think that pump draws something like 87 watts. So it's not a high draw pump to begin with to do a lot of work, so your advantage is mitigated. But you need to take that approach, and I encourage you to look at some of my aquatic videos and see how I do my returns. And maybe I should maybe do a walkthrough video this weekend as well, in addition to how to make an aquarium siphon, the different options for return. And that video, like, there's a lot of videos with it in it, but a video that's only dedicated to that. Now, let's say you listen to Jack and you go out and you buy yourself a 6-foot round tank for your sump. Now I have this extra 100-gallon tank. What do you do with it? You could think about it. I'm not saying you have to, but you could put that tank over one of your three tanks in the system, and you could run it as an additional tank, or you could run it as an ebb and flow bed. And you could run it over your sump, or you could run it over one of your other tanks, or you could run it somewhere in the system. It's up to you. So you wouldn't necessarily get rid of that tank unless you wanted to. And then my other thing is, what are you building? So the one thing that's in here, it doesn't say anything about what animals you're going to keep, what you're trying to grow, the area, is it shaded or not? Like, you need shade, bro, big time, right? Now, you will get some geothermal cooling if you take a 2-foot tank and bury it, 20 inches in the ground, and it's a 300 to 400-gallon tank. You'll get some if you do that. If you put a 100-gallon tank in the ground halfway, which is what your diagram shows me, so 6 inches, you're not going to get much at all. You're not going to get much at all. Anyway, hope that helps. That wraps things up for today. We already did item of the day at the beginning, so I'll just mention real quick again, we got the collapsible rain barrels this week, and we got the emergency air compressors this week from Vavor, and you can get 5% off everything at Vavor if you use my link available at tspaz.com or any of the links in any of the write-ups. I got a great one coming for you. Hopefully, we'll be dropping this Monday. Vavor just sent me, like, their badass, massively huge capacity electric sausage stuffer, and I love making sausage, and I am excited about this one. I requested that as a demo model as much for you guys as for me on this one, and we're going to be making some pork, sage, and apple sausage, and putting a video and a write-up and everything together, and hopefully we'll be dropping that Monday, Tuesday at the latest. And remember, you can always support us by doing your online shopping, starting at T-Spaz, or becoming an MSB member. I'll catch you tomorrow with that Friday flashback, and we'll do it all over again next week.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Revolution.